Good afternoon. Welcome to the another virtual event from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm Patrick Milliken, and I'm stuck in the little media office here tonight. We have three authors published by Crooked Lane Publishing with us this evening. Evie Hawtree, this is the brand new book, And by Fire. I have Mindy Carlson, Her Dying Day. I have it right here. And Kate, I'm terribly sorry, I don't have a copy to hold up. So Barbara, do you want to go ahead and do the introduction for that one?
I can do that. I have a copy of hers.
Oh, beautiful.
Excellent. The reason we don't have a copy is we sold all ours and I had to reorder them.
That's so, a good problem to have.
It's a great pleasure to welcome the three of you. It's always exciting for us to meet new authors and, you know, go in new directions. We'll be 33 years old in October, on October 3rd, and we have spent much of that introducing debuts or introducing our readers to authors they don't know. So when we talk about a curated collection, which is kind of a buzzword, what that really means is Patrick or I or somebody else on staff has read most of the books we sell, and certainly all of the books that we do events for. So here we go. So let's start with, I'm going to do this alphabetically by author, librarian that I am. Let us talk first to Mindy Carlson. Mindy?
Hey. I'm Mindy Carlson. I'm the author of Her Dying Day, which is a mystery about a documentary film student who is investigating the disappearance of a famous author from 20 years before.
So before we talk a little bit more about the book, what's your own background? Because it seemed to me you brought kind of an interesting background to writing. And this is Mindy's debut novel, but she's an experienced writer in other fields.
Yes. So my background is actually, deep background is animal science, pre-veterinary medicine. And then I got into university administration, and then that brought me oddly into writing parenting articles. And so I've been doing writing parenting articles for about 6 years now in a sort of a positive psychological mindset. And communications and system, family systems. And so I decided that I've always loved mysteries. Mysteries are my very first love. My mom was also a librarian. She was the director of our public library. And so I could read whatever I wanted. And once I, you know, finished all the Nancy Drew books, she handed me Agatha Christie and said, I think you might like this. And she was absolutely right. So I had always, you know, I had all of these mystery stories in my head that I wanted to, you know, somebody else to write. Why isn't somebody writing the story? And then I saw an interview with Toni Morrison, who said, if you want to read a story that's not out there yet, you just have to write it yourself. And so I decided that I would write a book, and I did.
Very good. Well, you made some interesting choices. And the background in writing parenting articles is germane to what we will be talking about. But I like the idea of a documentary filmmaker. There's a trend at the moment in writing fiction now with podcasters as investigators. You know, everybody's always looking for a new kind of sleuth. And back in the 90s, when the women's sleuth movement was really strong, basically, they were all private eyes. But they almost all had boyfriends who were cops because, you know, they didn't have any powers of arrest or any way to affect justice. And it got to be kind of boring, to be honest. I mean, some of the great series held up, but it was like, oh, look, another female PI, you know, with a boyfriend who's in some sort of a squad. So I found that your idea of having her as a documentary filmmaker was kind of a variation on the podcaster, or at least it gave her an authentic reason for me tunneling along, trying to investigate something. So what is it that you plunge June Masterson, the name of your documentary film student, what is the case that you, or the investigation that you plunge her into?
Well, I plunge her into researching the disappearance of Greer Larkin, who is a very famous mystery author in my world. And she grew up on a goat commune in the Adirondack Mountains, and these were some of the only books that she had available to her to read, and she just fell in love with the world that Greer Larkin had created for her hero, Oberlin Hurst, and she just like, it just lifted her out of the commune and sort of gave her a view of a different life to live. And so she, when she's old enough, you know, she's getting her filmmaker's degree, and she just decides that this is like, I owe this to her to figure out what happened, because she disappeared 20 years ago without a trace. You know, her car was there, it was open, her purse was there, her keys were there, and she just was gone. And nobody found a body, nobody had seen her since. And so June really feels like she owes it to her to figure out what happened.
Wow, you took the cue from Agatha Christie there.
I did.
Right, which is a still intriguing case. It's astonishing to me how many people are still writing about Agatha Christie and what happened to her. And they'll never really be a full explanation of it.
Oh no, because she never talked about it again. I mean, the root of the idea definitely came from an article I had read about the Agatha Christie disappearance back in 1923. I think it was 1923, 1926. And so I was like, what if she'd never come back? Like, what if she'd never been found? Right. And she claimed to have amnesia. She claimed to remember nothing, even though she had checked into this hotel that was 230 miles away from her house outside of London under the name of her husband's mistress, you know, and she just never spoke of it again. It's not even in her autobiography. She's refused to talk about it.
No, it's really true. But, you know, she was basically, all evidence is not a vengeful person. So I tend to believe it was a genuine psychotic break. Today, we're so casual about divorce, comparatively speaking, right. But it's really hard to imagine the trauma that she felt that divorce, was just upending her life. So I think she really did go into a fugue state. I've been to Harrogate and, you know, been to the site of where she was found and so forth. But mm-hmm. I tend to think that there's people are attributing sinister motives to it, or revenge motive to it, or publicity motives to it. I don't think that's true. But Evie, in this June, in your book, the author that vanished was a real child prodigy of an author, right? She was very, very young, having been so successful. So she's not an old person that we're looking for. She's going to be a middle-aged person if she's been gone 20 years.
Right. So I really thought long and hard about child fame, about these child actors and young people who go into reality television shows in their 20s and their and like 19, and sort of like what fame does to a person and that young, and kind of just like, so of course she's going to make these bad decisions. Of course she's going to try, like she has like a momager, you know, and of course she's going to try and get away from that person to the first person who has shown her any affection and any love. And, you know, their relationships, you know, she's making bad choices inside of that relationship. She's making bad choices inside of her relationship with her best friend, Rachel. And, you know, it made sense that for me, somebody that young, just like June is at that age, they're both making some of the same bad mistakes.
Well, that's true. There's a bit of a mirroring there. And there's a Me Too sort of theme in part for all this. We don't want to spoil it. But my own little summation at the very beginning when I wrote this up for our newsletter, this is an ambitious debut novel that is great fun to read, which it is, with some nice twists, lively characters, an interesting picture of documentary film studies and creation, an author long missing and presumed dead, a Me Too love affair that actually isn't, plus publishing and family drama. And it nearly all works. Anyway, I congratulate you, because that's a lot to keep track of. So let's now talk to Evie Hawtrey, who also has an awful lot going on in her book, and not only an awful lot going on, but in two different time periods. So Evie, tell us a bit about End by Fire.
Well, I have written a dual timeline crime novel. Then the commonality is two very fierce female detectives. One is actually a police detective with the City Police of London, and the other exists over 350 years in the past. And she's a lady in waiting to King Charles II's queen, who is a woman of science. She's fascinated by science in a time when the term woman of science really doesn't apply to much of anyone. And they are both pursuing basically murderous geniuses who are kind of willing to burn the world for their art, because I really wanted to look at the question of, as a creator, we all create, we writers create, we painters create, architects create. We all know that art requires sacrifice, but what happens when people are willing to cross the line from self-sacrifice to sacrificing things that are not excusable? So, I like a challenge. I thought, let's do this twice and let's see if Crimes Past can help Nigella Parker, who's my detective in the modern day London, to solve her present set of serial arson murders.
I think it worked really well. I mean, I was somewhat dubious when we started, but I thought you did it extremely well. I mean, Christopher Wren is a towering figure. You know, he's the man that to a great degree rebuilt London after the Great Fire of 1666, which, while it was truly tragic, it also cleaned London up from the bubonic plague, for a while. So in some ways, you know, it was a good thing, because the old city was so riddled with rats. Terrible sewage, lack of plumbing, no sanitation, whatever. But he really wanted to rebuild St. Paul's Cathedral, and in fact, eventually did. So that's what drives Wren in your story, is he's desperate.
Well, interestingly enough, I have written historical fiction for a decade under a different name. And I got interested in the Wren storyline quite a bit before I decided to do what I did with it, because I was listening to NPR, which I'm addicted to. And I was listening to a historian, a female historian, and she was talking about the Great Fire. And we all know the Great Fire is accidental, absolutely. And I'm not asserting that it's not in my book. I'm asserting what if during the Great Fire, someone decided to make sure something burned. And she said, you know, we all know it was an accident, but she said, you know who really benefited from this was Christopher Wren, because the slate was wiped clean and he could do what he wanted. And I was fascinated by the idea that at the time of the fire, he was pretty much an architectural nobody. He was a professor of astronomy at Oxford. He was just working on his very first real commission, which was a theater at the university. And he was on a committee that was considering what to do about St. Paul's with some of the biggest names of the time. And I mean, we've all been there. When you start new in a field and you're surrounded by giants, it can feel pretty hopeless. Even if you have a brilliant vision, how do you get that vision to be seen? And so that really resonated for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's actually a terrifyingly plausible idea that you had. I also was interested in Catherine of Braganza, who is, you know, to a great degree, a totally overlooked queen, but you give her, in the modern parlance, you give her a lot of agency in this story that did you find any real historical evidence for her being like that? Or did you, just because she's such a cipher really in most history, that you could attribute that to her?
Well, I think what I find moving about her is she was very religious. And also I have a blog post on this. People don't really realize she did impact the British court, maybe not as the way we would think if she had been married to someone who wasn't the Merry Monarch, who, you know, had dozens of mistresses. But for example, although she didn't bring tea to England, she made tea fashionable. It had been medicinal up to the point. And all of a sudden she brought beautiful tea sets with her, and everybody who was anybody wanted to have tea. And now you were saying you've been to Harrogate, so perhaps you've been to Betty's Tea Shop in Harrogate, which is one of my favorite tea shops. And, you know, tea is so British now. Well, the person who made that fashionable so that everybody from the members of the royal court to the merchant class were interested in sitting down and doing that in the afternoon was Queen Catherine of Braganza.
Very true. Yeah. And with her dowry, she actually brought Britain its foothold in India. Most people don't recognize that, but part of her dowry when she came to marry Charles II was territory in India. And I'm trying to remember if it was far enough north that it's part of the Tigray. Was it part of Assam? It might have been.
It might have been. And I know Portugal, because of their territories and because of their trading for so long, that is why they were so on the cusp with tea. But I just thought she was a very well-meaning person. And I think she was she would have liked to be more appreciated by her husband than she was. But I think I think she might be overlooked more than she deserves to be overlooked.
Well, she's a useful character in your book, let's put it that way, because we don't know that much about her. And she has a lady in waiting, Lady Margaret, and so Lady Margaret and the Queen, to some degree, are pushing an investigation in 1666. While meantime, in today's world, we have Nigella, is that how, I never know how to pronounce
Nigella.
It.
Nigella Parker.
I should know that from the cook, right? So Nigella, and she is investigating, as you say, serial arson. So how did you decide to structure the book? I mean, I think it works really well the way you did it, but did you find that to be the right structure from the beginning, or did you play around with it?
Well, I did this in a very strange way, which is I wrote the entire modern timeline first. And then I wrote the entire historical timeline, and then I edited as necessary to make sure they would fit. But by writing the modern timeline first, I also knew where I was going to need things to occur in the historical timeline. What is the most interesting thing, and I didn't really think, everybody admits this, I'm sure, I didn't really think this through. I needed the locations to tie into Christopher Wren. So it starts, no surprise, and in fact, if anyone has the audiobook of my book, the narrator of my audiobook, who I love so deeply, actually went to the Monument of the Great Fire on the day the book released, and she sent me video because she was in London to see family, and it was the highlight of my day. But I needed it to tie into Wren, and most of Wren's work, and certainly the monument, are within the city of London, which is 1.12 miles out of 600 plus miles of metropolitan London. Well, that made it multi-jurisdictional, which I wanted to do anyway, so that I could have O'Leary in there. But it means that if I continue this book and it becomes a series, I have to find dead bodies in less than a mile and a quarter of London over and over again, because there's two police forces. There's the city police, which is what Nigella is with, and then there's the more well-known, more famous metropolitan police, better known as Scotland Yard. So that I may have overcomplicated things for myself a little there.
Well, one of the things, we're all booky people here, so perhaps we all know that St. Paul's not only was the church, the old church, but this is where London's booksellers, this is where London's publishing industry was located, which is true in other countries as well. So in Jeopardy, and part of the story, in serious jeopardy with the fire going and the cathedral perhaps burning, is all the bookstores and the printmakers and so forth around the cathedral. And most of the time, these people lived above their shop. You know, they would have two-story houses. They would live above, and then the bottom was where they did the business and sold stuff out the front door, so to speak. This was before copyright and other things were terribly well established. So, but anyway, so the whole book world was in jeopardy in London, along with...
And I think people don't realize, and well, I obviously do because I live and breathe the Great Fire of London now, but 80% of the city within the walls burned.
Yeah.
And the fire, you know, for a long time, they had a very short list of people who died. And I don't think any historian now would say, oh, yes, only 12 people died. Oh, yes, because it was a rabbit warren, as you mentioned. And they had fire tornadoes like you saw in the firebombing of Dresden. So a lot of my sources said, at least where you had that level of conflagration, they're quite confident that temperatures exceeded 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So you're not even going to have teeth left. So yes, I think somewhere above 70,000 Londoners were left homeless by that fire. It was just apocalyptical. It's hard to imagine for us what it would be like to, in fact, I hope we never experience that. And I particularly do, because I'm sure you noticed my detective, Nigella Parker, has a childhood fear of fire, very deeply rooted fear of fire. And I gave that to her. That's my fear. And it comes from a very similar story, which I don't want to give anything away, that happened in my town when I was a little girl. And so sometimes I give characters things because they're familiar to me. But in this case, I think I kind of gave that to her because now it's hers and hopefully it's not mine anymore.
Oh, I hope not. I mean, none of us, you know, part of Arizona's burning as we're speaking. Yeah, it's coming towards Flagstaff again. It's hard to say with the climate change and the, you know, extraordinary drought and so forth, whether we aren't going to see some. But, you know, the problem with London was that everything was packed together in a density, and they didn't really even know how many people lived there. So, you know, the tally will never be accurate of what happened. So let's move on from fire to poison. Why not? You know, this is a mystery program after all. So Kate, this is a really wonderful book. And I have to ask you at the outset, have you read Deanna Rayburn's series?
I have read one of her series, but people ask me that all the time because my publisher was extremely generous in comping me to her in my like initial press for the book. So yes, I have read her and she's fantastic.
She is fantastic, but there are a lot of parallels between Veronica Speedwell and your main character, which is why people keep asking you about it. Saffron, in her way, is very similar to Veronica. And it's a wonderful series. I think people love the idea of, you know, young women, let's come back to agency again, having more agency than we might have been willing to or even thought that we could attribute to them in the time that they are operating. So tell us a bit about A Botanist's Guide to Parties and Poisons, which is a very nice title, by the way.
It is. It's a wonderful title. I can take no credit. It was my editor. So thank you, Melissa, for the amazing title. So A Botanist's Guide to Parties and Poisons follows Saffron Everly, who is a botany research assistant at the University College London in 1923. And she has faced struggles, as you would expect of any young woman in a very male-dominated field in the 20s. And she is invited to a dinner party and she goes to kind of hobnob with people and try to make connections and network, as we call it now. And the night ends with one of the professor's wives on the floor, poisoned. And unfortunately, her mentor and the professor who she assists is accused, more or less arrested eventually, of poisoning Mrs. Henry, Dr. Henry's wife. So Saffron is like, this is not true. This is not possible. My mentor slash father figure would never do this. So she takes it upon herself to correct what she believes to be the wrongs that our lead detective, Inspector Green, is carrying out. And so she determines to save Dr. Maxwell by solving
the crime. She makes a bold move in that she actually tests a potential poison, possibly the lethal poison, on herself. You know, she's a very courageous and I would say somewhat headstrong.
Yeah, you might call it courageous. You might call it a little reckless, maybe a little dumb.
I was trying to find the nice word there, but yeah.
No, but that's the thing is that like, she's young. She is obviously like into science and she's very determined. And so I personally love that she makes a kind of a dicey move. I love that she makes kind of a move that other people would say is foolish.
Well, you know, scientists over the ages have sometimes experimented on themselves. So it's not like she's the very first person to do that. Most of them survived. Some of them, well, the ones that carried on did survive, clearly, or we wouldn't have known any more about them. But
yeah.
So how did you come by the knowledge of botany that is essential to make this character and this plot work?
Google. I learned from Professor Google. I have a great interest in plants and I have a great love of gardening. And when I was deciding that Saffron would be a botanist, I first thought to myself, what would be a discipline that would be helpful in solving a crime, first of all? And second of all, what would be something that I would not mind spending hours and hours and hours researching myself and learning about? Because when I began, I'm like, I don't know anything more than like leaves and flowers and roots pretty much. And I had to learn a great deal more than that, in terms of the actual botany, but also a bit about chemistry, which was, like Saffron, it was like the only class that I ever truly failed. So that was an interesting, bit of research, having to figure out some chemistry stuff.
It's so interesting because Imperial Britain, part of Imperial Britain, which was moving us along through the Industrial Revolution and various other changes, was basically about stealing botanicals from other countries that could be useful in Britain, hence Kew Gardens, where they would bring them back. So there's the whole rubber tree saga, where they went up the Amazon to Manaus and actually stole some rubber tree pods, which were under heavy guard. I mean, it's a fabulous story. It's really industrial espionage, except plants. Brought it back to Kew Garden, and then they replanted it in Malaysia, and hence we got the whole rubber industry in Southeast Asia that World War II then abandoned. And I was just in French Polynesia in April, and all my life since I saw the original Mutiny on the Bounty with Charles Laughton and Gregory Peck and all, I've wondered about the breadfruit tree, because that was actually part of the mission that the Bounty went on. And Captain Bligh, after the mutiny, in an open boat across like 2,000 miles of the Pacific, kept the breadfruit trees alive and brought them back to Kew Gardens. And it turns out that they are astonishingly nutritious. They're like the potato. There are so many calories in breadfruit that Polynesians were able to bring them along, transplant them to island and island as they went along, and people could survive on them. I never really got it. But the British have an enormous history of acquiring plants from other places, sometimes as flowers. I think it's Baron Rothschild, his whole deal was orchids. And, you know, they sent people to the Himalayas to bring plants back. So nothing about your book is unusual in that sense. But I like it that you and Mindy both decided on an academic setting and academic relationships, because they can be pretty poisonous. I've always congratulated myself that I decided not to become a professor years and years ago, because it's an absolute snake pit. And codes of ethics are really difficult to maintain. Mindy, you have that going on because there's an inappropriate relationship with the professor and your protagonist, or maybe it's not inappropriate, but it's a relationship.
Yeah, it's in a really, and I would call it inappropriate. I mean, he's her advisor. He is in a power position over her. And, you know, she is an adult, she's of age, and she might think that this is, you know, that she has agency in this, but you know, she does have a little bit of agency in it, but how much does she really have at the end? You know, at the end of the day, he's her advisor and he's going to pass her or fail her.
Right. So there is a lot of power vested in the hierarchies in academia. And Safran has interesting relationships. Her father is kind of the key in many ways to how things work for her. Am I right, Kate?
I would say definitely. He was a professor before he went off to the Great War and eventually died at on the ground there. And so she has at once an opening because she has connections at the university, especially through Dr. Maxwell and a couple of the other professors who were friendly with him. But at the same time, it is a burden to her because a lot of her fellow students and then fellow researchers believe that she's only there because of nepotism, because her father was there, and that she did not earn her way into her position.
Right.
So it is definitely it's a double-edged thing of that is probably the reason why she was able to get as far as she did, in addition to being talented, because during the time period, it was not unheard of for women to be students or professors. The University College London had professors who were women before the turn of the century, but you know, different time period, different standards.
I do like the fact that this is University College London. I mean, so often we think British academia, we're either in Oxford or Cambridge.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not so interesting to be a red brick university in Manchester or Birmingham or something, but University College London, where I have been, actually, there was a mystery conference held at University College in London, and we all had to sleep in the dormitories, which I'm telling you, British student housing really toughens you up. It can be pretty grim. So that was a wonderful experience. Tell us about Dr. Alexander Ashton. I love his name. It's got a nice ring to it, but you brought in what, a potential romance and a potential sleuthing partner?
Yeah, I mean, I knew going in that romance would be an important element of the books, because basically when I sat down to write this, I'm like, I'm going to write my perfect mystery and it's going to have all of these things in it. And romance was like at the top of the list. So I knew that I wanted to have some romance and I knew that I wanted to have a hero that was just as interesting as the heroine. I wanted him to be really multifaceted and, you know, have a history and all of this stuff. He does not exist to help Saffron. He has his own stuff going on, which sometimes maybe in the future will conflict with what she's trying to do. But he is a veteran of the First World War. He suffers from PTSD, but he's also a very successful biologist who travels all over the world, including going to the Amazon.
Very true. In fact, Brazil figures in, or the Amazon is his goal, because part of what's going on here is the department is putting together an expedition to the Amazon, and who will get to go is part of the, you know, somebody said once about academia that, you know, that I'm trying to remember how it goes, something about the stakes are so low, but, you know, the behavior is so high for stakes that are so low, something along those lines. But they're not to academics, because, yeah, you know, not just knowledge, but, you know, status at the university is, or wherever they're teaching is a big part of it. So you other two, what do you think about romance? Do you think that romance is an interesting part of your novel, Evie?
Well, I don't really view it as romance. Here's how I view it. Characters need to be fully human. Mm-hmm. And most people who are fully human have complicated interpersonal relationships. So in my case, I have, even though we're talking about modern day, women still have to run harder, stronger, faster to get the same place. So I've got a police detective who is trying to solve serial arson murders where somebody is literally posing bodies like sculptures. And she's trying to do that with someone that she had a relationship with. But she does not believe in put your whole soul into it sort of relationship. She doesn't have time for that. So I like to say they were an item till he uttered three little words. And we all know that's I love you. And then all this stuff went in a bag and he got put out. And she has to kind of deal with being relationship phobic because they do have a friendship and they do have a lot in common. And she does come to appreciate him on a different level. And certainly Lady Margaret, the actual Etienne Belland, who is her love interest, is a real character. He was really a royal fireworks maker. He's the son of one. And he actually was accused by a group of people of causing the Great Fire of London with things he bought for a firework display, but that didn't go anywhere. But I have had people say to me, well, it's a police procedural mostly, so why did you do this? And I said, well, anytime I read a book or watch a BBC series, I don't come back to the series just for the science. There's not enough science in the world to hold me in a series. But if I care about the characters, you can make 100 episodes of Father Brown, I'm going to watch them. So I think that's how I view it is. I want my people flawed and I want them human, and that means they have to have relationships.
I want to come back to Lady Margaret, but let's see what you have to say about introducing romance.
Oh, I think romance is very important.
Or relationship. I probably shouldn't call it romance. I think you're right. Just a relationship.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, relationships are the cornerstone of any good mystery. You know, I just published an article on Crime Reads today about if you want to write a good mystery, you need to read a good romance, because you have to understand how the relationships build, and then you can rip them apart a lot more effectively. You have better motive, you have better dialogue, you have better emotions, because you understand how they got to that place where everything just falls apart. So romance and relationships are really important in a book.
They are, but you know, most of the time when you're dealing with a professional crime solver, police or whatever it is, their relationships are always strained by the fact that their constant preoccupation is working the case. And you know, there's an interesting French series. We've been watching a lot of French detective stories during, you know, the pandemic and so forth. And this one, Balthazar is called. He's actually a medical examiner. He's a really interesting guy. But he and the woman cop that he has to work with, they both have relationships that are just constantly under stress or destroyed by the fact that they are so consumed with their investigations, you know, that their children, their spouses, whatever, wind up taking a second seat. So how are you going to balance that in your books? Who wants to go first? Let's go back up the cake. Let Mindy do it, right.
Okay. Even though they're strained relationships, they're still relationships. It's still a very realistic way of relating to the people close to you. I grew up on a family farm where it was my dad and his two brothers and all of my cousins and my brothers and stuff working on the farm together. And you want to talk about learning complicated relationship dynamics, you just work with family, you know? And so it's the strained relationships, though, those are still legitimate and important into the book, because nobody wants to read a book where everybody gets along.
Evie?
I think also relationships can be a safe place. And especially if someone understands your business, if someone understands what you do. My former iteration was as a large firm antitrust lawyer, and I'm married to a lawyer. And there's a reason for that. When you do law on that level in Washington, D.C., you have to know what the stresses are. You have to know what the hours are. I sometimes think as long as you don't work at the same place, and my detectives don't work in the same police department, it's an asset to be with someone who knows that you're not staying 16 hours at work because you don't like the kids or you don't want to walk the dog. That's what it takes to get the job done. And I agree with Mindy. I think that stress is part of all relationships, but the best relationships also are a balm for that stress. And I think that's the direction that I want my character to grow and to see that there are plus sides to really investing yourself in someone and to letting them invest themselves in you. And that's not necessarily a frightening thing.
How about you, Kate?
Y'all kind of said all the things. Like y'all did such a good job just like explaining it so well. Because like on the one hand, as an author, I'm like, I need to establish some conflict because conflict is what drives, you know, the whole story. But on the other hand, like I want my characters to also be happy, like to some extent. They can't get too happy, otherwise it's boring. But I want, like I would love for Saffron and whoever to find that comfort with each other and being each other's helpmate and being the other who the other person can rely on. But I also know that she already has a person who's like that, and that is her flatmate, Saffron's flatmate, Elizabeth, who they've been best friends since they were very young children. They moved to London together to kind of escape their families. And so they are that person to each other already, where they can rely on each other and they yell at each other and borrow clothes and you know, give each other a hard time. But at the end of the day, you know that they're gonna be there for each other. And I have a person who's like that for me. So I wanted Saffron to have that too, because one of the things that drives me the most crazy is when a romance overtakes every other aspect of the book. Unless it is a romance, in which case, like, sure, that's the whole point. But I really wanted a balance of relationships, and I wanted them to not only talk about the guys, but also talk about like what's going on in the case and see what new information she could bring to the table. So, yeah, I think balancing not only the romantic relationships, but the friendships as well, and showing as both of you guys said, showing your characters as whole people who are not just about the job, because like you can be about the job the whole time, but that has to be a choice that you make for that character. It can't just be because you don't want to write other aspects of their lives.
I brought it up because conflict is such an important part of moving the story forward and defining the characters. And so certainly that kind of conflict, not just, you know, the conflict with the, you know, with the bad guy, that sort of thing, but within the detective's life, their family relationship, their personal relationships, and all can really contribute to it as well. But you don't want it to be all negative either. Good point that they have to have moments of real happiness somewhere, or otherwise they'd probably all just cut their throats and that would be the end of the whole story, right? Where would we go? So I wanted to come back to something Evie brought up, because I thought it was an important part of your book in the 1666 part, which is that Lady Margaret comes from an upper class family. It's hard, if you're gonna write British mystery, you have to take class into account. You know, the whole trope about if you're an American author, you have to think about race. If you're gonna write about, if you're gonna write British or look at the British, you have to think about class. But she's very much attached or attracted to this fireworks gentleman, but he doesn't come from the same class that she is. And her family regards her as a financial asset. And they thought, So, you know, they can marry her off for money, and they're not going to be interested in her pursuing a relationship that is not going to benefit the family. And that creates a lot of stress for her. And I think, you know, that was a good reminder of how women were really thought of as, you know.
Right. She's valuable property. And it's bad enough. I mean, he's not titled, because he is quite affluent for a tradesman, but he's not titled, but he's also foreign. He's French. Right. And he is Catholic. So it's the triple threat. I mean, that is doomed. And I think that one of the things I really appreciate about coming from the background in historical fiction is understanding that progress for women or for anything else in history is not linear, but also understanding the first book I ever wrote was about sisters who became queens in the 13th century. And understanding that whole aspect, I think that was one of the gifts of doing that other genre first.
Right. So did you think about that, Kate, when you were writing Saffron? You know, was she in any way a sort of financial asset for her family, or is she, with her father dead and so forth, is she much more independent?
The answer to that is complicated, and it's talked about a bit more in the second book in the series, which will come out next year, A Botanist's Guide to Flowers and Fatality. Definitely deals with that a little bit more. But she, I was going to say, like, I mean, she's in the same boat pretty much. I mean, what is it, like 300 years later? Saffron is still considered to be not quite like her family's property, but like they think that they have the right to determine what she does and who she marries and where she lives and everything. So she really had to remove herself in order to get the independence that she required to finish her degree, live in London, gain employment. She doesn't receive any financial support from them, although she does from her mother. It's not on page, but it's in my head that her mother does help her, because she has independent means that she can like sneak Saffron and Elizabeth.
You can read Jane Austen and pick all this up. I'm glad they're making a new version of Persuasion, which I think is one where that, you know, worthy suitor in class really comes into play.
Exactly.
Remarkably well. And it'll be interesting to see in a new version of it, whether any modern sensibility creeps in. Because that's a no-no for historical fiction.
That's what I've been thinking about a lot, because I've read some reviews that I know I'm not supposed to, I do anyway. That is something that people have mentioned in reviews about, either saying there's too much modern sensibility or too little modern sensibility, which of course is the nature of your reviews. Like some people think it's too fast or too slow or whatever. But it's really tricky. I was actually going to ask you, Evie, like how you interpreted through a 2021, 2022 lens, your heroines that were very far back in history. 1923 has a lot more in common to now than your heroines do in terms of what they're able to do. Because I mean, Saffron was able to live outside the house and make a wage, and your people probably would not have been able to do that as easily.
Well, to be honest, I actually think I would rather be a woman of certain status in the 13th century than in the 17th century. Because at the time of my 13th century queens, they held property in their own right. They inherited property in their right. It did not become their husbands when they got married. And there were incidents in their family where one of their uncles married a queen. And when she died, he had to leave the country. So people think it's linear and it's really not. I actually think that I don't try to dress it up. Do I put every gross thing in? Like, no. I mean, if anybody ever really wants to read something unbelievably gross, I have a blog, forget the fire, I have a blog on puppy water, which is a complexion thing that was popular in that period of time that you're going to wish was puppy urine after you read it. So I don't play up the things that will turn off the audience, although I did write a blog on that because it was irresistible. But I don't want to... I don't want to modernize, but I also want people to recognize that every woman in every era is not the same. We see that in our modern time. You meet 100 women. There is no one way to be a woman in 2022. And the same is true for 1666.
It's interesting to me that Bridgerton decided to bring together a multiracial cast that, you know, was clearly not possible in the time that Bridgerton took place. But it does make me think, you know, how much a writer today has to take into account modern sensibilities in writing historical fiction or not. You know, I think my own view is you should be true to the time and not intrude, you know, not be censoring language or having people have attitudes that simply they just didn't have. I mean, that's part of this whole debate about reparations and so forth. You know, today, I think it's an extremely complicated question, but I think you have to be true to the era that you're writing in. And maybe that's hard to do. I didn't feel that you were too modern, Kate. I thought you did a really good job with it.
Thank you. I think, I agree with you to some extent, especially because I think that there is a lot to be learned about like the ignorance that, you know, people exhibited in these eras in particular. I think about the 1920s and I like shudder to think some of the opinions that the people of the day held that were considered completely normal and appropriate. But the challenge is that, for the average reader, they might not have an awareness of what it was like. Like they just might not know. And they might think that it comes across as like my opinion. Like at one point, one of the characters is commenting on like unruly natives when they're talking about the expedition. And clearly, like, I don't hold that view of the native people of any country. I don't find them to be like unruly or violent or whatever. But the people of that day did. Like they had a fear of you know, all kinds of horrific things because people brought back stories and all of that kind of thing. So I think it's a really challenging balance because there is the expectation that it will be corrected by another character. Like they'll say, the unruly natives are gonna attack us. And then someone else is like, don't be dumb. They're perfectly civilized people. Like that is a very modern viewpoint. But it is, a lot of people expect that to happen. They expect those key corrections to happen on the page. And so you have to balance that expectation with trusting your audience that they will realize that that is not your opinion. That is just because you're writing in that time period.
We're living in a hypertensive age and one filled with microaggressions and other sorts of things. And I do think it's hard. It's very hard, in fact, to write anything that is not going to offend somebody somewhere. So you just have to stay true to yourself, I think, in your vision and ideally.
Well, some of the best literature has always offended.
Yeah, I know. When you look back at some of the books that were banned, you know, once in a while when there's banned book time or, you know, banned book week, I think it is, it's astonishing to look at some of the books that, you know, in their time were considered to be worthy of being banned. And today we go, seriously, you know, but that's a whole other question. So I don't want to assume that you've all had time to read each other's books. Would I be wrong or right in thinking that you have or have not? Have you read each other's books? Let me ask the question.
At least parts of them. At least
parts. Well, I only asked it because I thought if you wanted to ask each other questions, it would sort of require you to have read the book. So let me ask Evie, since you've read part, is there something you'd like to ask?
Yes, actually, Edward, a couple of things. I'm going to ask Mindy something. And it ties into something I said earlier about giving my fear of fire to Nigella. I'm going to assume that you did not grow up on a goat commune like your film student detective, Pear Blossom, better known as June. But what, if anything, did you share of Mindy with June?
Actually, I didn't grow up in a commune, but I did live in a commune in Berkeley.
Wow, my mind is blown. I'm so glad I asked this question.
Yeah, I moved to Berkeley after college, and I just found a place in a communal living situation. So I did live in a commune. So that part of June is part of me, definitely.
What about the goats?
You just made me happy on levels I cannot describe. So thank you for sharing that.
I did not have goats. I grew up on a organic Angus beef farm. And I raised my own pigs, and that is part of how I paid for college.
That's so cool.
And I actually have one for Kate, if you don't mind, Kate.
Sure, carry on.
So it's interesting because both of us have a historical timeline. And even though there were different eras, and both of them are in London, but I obviously had to set my story in London. I didn't really have a choice, given it was going to involve Christopher Wren. And so I'm curious why you chose London and why specifically 1923? Because 1666 is the Great Fire of London. Mm-hmm. That's got to be the year. But I know there has to be something behind that very precise choice of year and setting.
I knew that I wanted it to be in the 20s, but 23 just happens to be my favorite year or my favorite day or not day, number. So I knew that I wanted it to be 20s, and I wanted it to be early 20s because I also knew I wanted it to be a series. So I wanted to give myself plenty of time in the 1920s to write. But the more I learned about it, the more I was like, oh, this is actually kind of a cool time period. Because we're 5 years out or ish from the war ending. So it's not far enough to be a distant memory, but it's also not all anyone can think or talk about. So I wanted some distance, but not too much distance from that. And why London was just because I love London. And I thought it'd be a really fun place to set a mystery, especially at a university, because you're not kind of separate off, like in Cambridge, for example. It's like it's very isolated in terms of like I don't know how to describe it. It's a very insular community. Whereas if you're in London, yes, you have that insular community of the university, but you also have the entire city to work with. And if I'm being honest again, the University College London was the first university I came across when I researched universities that accepted women at the time.
You know, what's interesting is if you ever read my book, I have a tiny character in my book. She's a receptionist, one of the victims hits on, who is studying architecture at the University of London. So when I got to University of London, your book, the bells went off and the whistles blew, and I thought, I know exactly what page in my book that comes up. So
that's so funny. Yeah. No, I really, and I kind of lucked out because the University College London is really cool. Like the campus is cool. My lights are flickering, but it's a really cool place, and it's really set in the city. So it's, you know, it's in the hustle and bustle.
So Kate, do you have questions that you would like to ask either Mindy or Evie?
Well, I have questions that are more just like curiosity, author, writer friend questions. Can you tell me like your best read from this year? I would love, I'm like always searching for recommendations for what to read next. So like top nine, what year are we? We've been passing around too many dates. 2022 read of the year.
Mindy, you want to take that one?
Sure, I'll start. What, there are so many. I have books piled everywhere. I think one of my favorite reads that I've had so far this year was Meg Cobb's book, My Summer Darlings. I think that's one of my favorite reads so far.
I'll write this down.
Yeah, no, that was fantastic. And then Isabel Allende's Long Petal of the Sea to the Sea, Long Petal. Yeah, that was
Long Petal is fantastic. The crucial, right. Mm-hmm.
I don't read mystery when I'm writing mystery, and I don't read historical fiction when I'm writing historical fiction. So when I'm writing mystery, I read historical fiction. So Kate Quinn's Diamond Eye comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And also Eliza Knight has a book about the bright young things that Nancy Mitford called The Mayfair Bookshop. But to be honest, I read a lot of nonfiction, and currently I am reading the which I don't recommend unless you really like to see a lot of naked prisoners. I'm reading the Encyclopedia of Russian Prison Tattooing, Volume 1, and it's on my desk. So pretty soon I'm going to be able to decode prison tattoos in a way that really will be embarrassing for a middle-aged lady.
Is that research for another book?
Yes, please tell me it's not. Please tell me it's not.
No,
it's
it
just
is.
It's fun.
No, it's both. It's fun and research, because research is fun.
It is. So. Well, that reminds me of another question. Evie, I know exactly what you had to research for this book, but Mindy, what was something you had to research for your book?
I actually had to research filmmaking. Like, because I am not a filmmaker. I may have been on a commune. I'm not a filmmaker. I went to Google University. And look that up. But I also have friends of friends who are in the film industry and doing specifically reality TV shows. And so I asked them for some guidance. I also have a friend who is a doctor, and I text him weird questions about things like poisons and bullet holes, and he particularly loves the poison questions. He runs down to the toxicology department, and they absolutely love to see him walk through the door with his phone out going, I have a question.
I thought one of the interesting things about your documentary filmmaking as you know, part of the book, was the permissions that needed to be acquired. I mean, she's very pushy in order to make this documentary, much like a reporter would be. And, you know, I found it interesting, people's reactions. Why would they want to be part of it? If they didn't, what was their objection? What sort of code of ethics, if any, binds her as a documentary filmmaker? Did you have to look all that stuff up, or did you kind of do it as you felt it would be appropriate when you were writing it?
I mean, I definitely looked all that stuff up. Because there really is a very tight code of ethics around shooting documentaries. You have to be true to the subject. You can't be clipping interviews together to give you a narrative arc that you want that is not the truth. I mean, as long as it's the truth, you can kind of, you can clip it to sort of make it tighter and more narrative, but you can't distort what the person is saying. You have a responsibility, like journalism, you have a responsibility to tell the truth. And so I did do research on that, but then everybody's different reactions as far as like why they wanted to be a part of it, that was all very organic. There's vengeance there. There's, wanting to see someone get a comeuppance. You know, there's just what I want the truth out there. It's got, I've been living under this dark cloud for years, and I need the truth to be, to finally be told. Their motives were all very different, but yeah, I did research the code of ethics around.
You did a really very good job with what is basically an invasion of privacy, taken up to a great extent, although it's part of the point of the documentary film. So, it's not gratuitous, but I thought you brought in some very interesting ideas. for discussion, really. I mean, they're just there, but I think the reader can think about them afterward. So were any of you required to write a discussion guide or thought about writing a discussion guide for your books? I've never asked that question before. It just popped into my mind.
I did a book club guide because I am addicted to book clubs. I love book clubs. And so I did a book club guide, and it's actually on my website. Anyone can download it. And I had that experience from prior books. And so I enjoy doing that. And I didn't really come up with any for prior books. I was designated as the cocktail designer for a group novel that I worked on with Kate Quinn and a number of people called Ribbons of Scarlet. And for some reason, they thought I was the person who should create the book club cocktails. But in this case, that was easy for me because I came up with something based on plague water, which is a lot nicer than it sounds. And plus, the British just drink a lot of gin. But you can definitely, if anyone's interested, go to my website and print it, and it's there. And I love that because I love the idea of, I think our characters, and I know you ladies are going to agree on this, our characters continue to live through readers. And that's the most exciting thing about it. Every reader reads our characters differently and sees our characters differently, and they go out into the world and live through other people. And so I think one of the reasons I love book clubs and discussion guides is when you hear, especially if you're there virtually or in person, when you hear people discuss your book, it's like standing behind a curtain hearing somebody discuss your children. And it's just really exciting.
You know, you brought up an interesting point. We have had discussion clubs at the bookstore for over 30 years. And initially, we thought it would be cool to invite the author. Of course, we didn't have Zoom technology then, so it had to be like in person if we were going to do that. And then we recognized that if the author were there, the discussion would not flow as it might if the author were not there, particularly if anybody wanted to be critical. This was when people were probably better mannered, and you know, we've moved a long way away from civility in the last 25 years. But anyway, so we made a decision not to invite authors to participate because the discussion would be franker without. So I think if you think about the characters as authors' children, which I think often we do, you know, you don't want to criticize people's children or be brutal to them in front of them. Makes it an interesting point. What about you, Kate? Did you think about discussions?
I have thought about it, but I've just never done it. I do have a couple book club dates on my calendar though, so I guess I'll find out if they want me to write down some questions for discussion or not. But I do have on my website a botanical index. That is kind of what I did in lieu of that, because I knew that I have like 25 plants that are mentioned in the book, and I figured people didn't want to be constantly Googling them. So I just put them all in one place on my website. So if anybody is curious about the plants, you can go to kcavari.com and find out what they are.
That's very nice.
If anybody's poisoned in your neighborhood, you know they're coming to your house now.
Good point. Mindy, what do you think?
About, discussion guides? Yeah. I've been a part of a book club actually for 21 years now. And so I've not been approached to do a discussion guide for this book, but our book club discussion really, I don't know. I feel like book clubs have been around long enough that discussion can really flow from them pretty naturally. I mean, you get enough practice sort of reading a book critically, and you're just like, oh, I loved this part, and I loved this part, and I had questions about this, and what did you think about this theme, and you know, so yeah, I don't think the book club that I'm a part of, I don't think we've ever used the discussion questions in the back of a book, maybe three times in 21 years.
This is why I create menus, not questions.
Yeah.
You nailed it.
You may all be invited to, you know, take place or to attend a book club somewhere, and you know, it'd be an interesting experience, I think.
Well, they're coming to my house tomorrow, so we're going to see what they think of my book.
Well, there you are. You know, that's probably the most direct feedback you can get, assuming you don't read your Amazon reviews, which I recommend that you never do. Let's call Patrick up and see if there are any questions or things that he would like to introduce to this.
Hey, we're actually getting ready to start PK's one of the book discussion groups this evening. We have a science fiction group that PK is about to do. As far as questions, I think they're all awed by what a fascinating discussion it's been. I don't see any real questions. I keep asking, but.
Okay. Well, it's been very wide ranging. I mean, I think all your books are wonderful and they're all, there's so many things to consider that, you know, are worth more time than we have. Let me put it that way. Anyway, it's been a great pleasure to meet you all. Thank you so much for joining us. And I guess the final question I should ask is, what are you working on now? Because, you know, with debuts particularly, people are always wondering what's next. So Mindy, are you, you've already mentioned that you're writing a sequel or at least another book, sorry.
Yeah, no, I have two more books that I'm working on that are not part of this, part of the June Masterson, but that's a standalone book. I have one that is the TV show Friends meets and then There Were None that I'm working on now. And then I have another one that I am in the middle of doing some pretty major edits on.
That sounds wonderful. How about you, Evie?
Well, I'm working on a historical project, of course, because I always am with my Sophie hat on. But actually, I am working on what I hope will be a second in series for this book, because I don't feel like I'm done with Nigella yet. And I don't think she's done with me. And it will definitely have Russian prison tattoos in it.
Well, seemed inevitable. Right. And how about you, Kate?
I have passed off my second draft to my editor for A Botanist's Guide to Flowers and Fatalities, and now I'll be working on an urban fantasy project about contemporary magic and vampires. So, kind of different.
Well, so much to talk about with all of you. What fun. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us, and I hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. Good night.
Thank you so much for having us.
Bye, guys.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.